KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I was the one who's like, you know, taking 5 years to edit a skate video, and it's like, oh, I want to be in Bing's video. So when I came back, they were probably really psyched to be filmed by me, and then probably weirded out that I wanted to follow all these other aspects of their lives.
Growing up in Rockford, Illinois, a city outside Chicago that's seen better days, director and cinematographer Bing Liu was obsessed with making skateboarding videos. Over the course of 12 years, one of those mini-movies morphed into a feature-length coming-of-age documentary called Minding the Gap. Liu tells KCRW's Matt Holzman about following his friends and their fractured families, camera in hand, to make Minding the Gap, which is now available on Hulu. And he tells us why he, very reluctantly, decided to include himself in his movie. But first on the News Banter, when is time really up? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my comrade in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we are entering a phase of the Time's Up movement, which was foreseeable. People started asking about this quite a while ago, which is, when is someone able to come back from transgressions? And in the post-Harvey Weinstein weeks and months, we were, like a lot of publications, we were deluged with complaints about misconduct. And, you know, in many cases, these were things like the Kevin Spacey allegations, which I think we can agree that kind of allegation is pretty much a career ender. You know, you don't come back from that kind of repeated violent, allegedly criminal assault. For Harvey Weinstein, he will hope to stay out of prison. But there's all this other type of behavior. And I feel like with the passage of time, it's come more clearly into focus. And we saw it this past week, first of all, with Jessica Chastain said she wanted to make a film with an Australian director, Matthew Newton. He is a guy with a history of assault on two of his girlfriends and various other people. And this is kind of pretty serious assault, like assault. He has said that he has been sober and dealt with his mental health issues, and he has been leading a quiet life for the past 6 years, trying to make amends. But, you know, Jessica Chastain's public, or the public at large, didn't seem to be too ready to accept that.
Right. And the backlash to that was so swift that this director actually stepped down from the project. And who knows if it'll actually get made now.
I mean, he wrote it. So, yeah, without him, it's a little rough. Yeah.
But I mean, it's really emblematic of where we are in this Time's Up movement, because Jessica Chastain, one of the women at the forefront of this movement, had decided that this director was okay to work with and that he had either rehabilitated himself or enough time had passed or whatever her rationale. And she was rebuffed by this backlash, and ultimately this guy had to step down. So I don't think Time's Up or any of us really know what the standard is that should be applied here. And it's so fact specific that you really have to judge it in each situation.
And people may not agree. For example, Les Moonves is still on the job. He's being investigated for a series of allegations that were laid out in The New Yorker by Ronan Farrow. Some of these allegations were, well, almost all of them were more than 20 years old. There was one that was more than 10 years old. So the question was, you know, was the kind of conduct of a person who's in a power position to hire and fire, you know, making a move on a potential employee or somebody who's worked with or for him, that has been illegal for a long time. But the standard of behavior, certainly in Hollywood, wasn't exactly in tune with what was legal and not legal. So it's not clear what will happen. I mean, Leslie Moonves is in the middle of a battle, as we've talked about many times, with Sherry Redstone. So there's a lot going on there. But meanwhile, I think he's the first person to say, I'm going to sit in the chair while I'm being investigated.
Yeah, and as we've seen with some of these other executives, typically once they start looking, they uncover other stuff and it's downhill from there and they don't return. So this is a bold move for him to still be there while this investigation is going on. One other thing I wanted to mention here is studios and networks are now being put in this position where a number of these people who have been accused and have been investigated or have dealt with some of these allegations of sexual misconduct, they're now coming back. They are either fronting the second season of their show, as James Franco is doing with The Deuce on HBO, which is returning in early September. And he was accused of some sexual misconduct in January. And you have Casey Affleck, who famously was sued for sexual harassment by two women who claimed that they were subjected to inappropriate behavior on the set of his movie, I'm Still Here, which was released in 2010. Casey Affleck won the Oscar for Best Actor 2 years ago, and then all of the avalanche of Me Too allegations came forward, and these former claims against him were put in a new context, and many people think that he wouldn't have won Best Actor had he been up this year rather than the year before. Now he's back, and he did an interview with the AP in which he sort of tried to get ahead of any backlash that might be coming and take responsibility for some of the atmosphere that he created on set, but not really directly address the allegations that were made against him.
Let's take a little listen to that.
It was an unprofessional environment. And, you know, the buck had to stop with me as being one of the producers. And I have to accept responsibility for that. And that was a mistake. And I contributed to that unprofessional environment.
Yeah, so he does not directly in this cut say anything about the allegations in the lawsuit. Maybe he's precluded from discussing them specifically. Maybe he's concerned that if he denies them too vociferously, he will be stirring the pot with the other women, whatever. It will be interesting to see. Like, they are putting him out there, but only in a very limited capacity with one outlet so far, the Associated Press. With someone like him, with someone like James Franco, with someone like Matthew Weiner, who's coming back with the Romanoffs, having been accused of misconduct on Mad Men, with a couple of high-profile women on the record, you know, talking about uncomfortable behavior, harassing behavior. You know, this is not just about touching, but it's also about creating a hostile work environment, making people feel ill at ease consistently. So does Matthew Weiner go out and promote the Romanoffs on Amazon? You know, there's a lot of stars in that show who could potentially go out, but does he?
I don't know. That remains to be seen. We do know that James Franco is not really doing press for The Deuce for season two, and he's the star of that show with Maggie Gyllenhaal. And HBO, which is releasing that show, they are very steadfastly in support of him, and they are backing him. And Casey Bloys, the head of HBO programming, has said that. The same with Fox Searchlight, which is releasing Casey Affleck's movie. They gave a statement to Hollywood Reporter this week saying that Casey was lovely to work with and has been completely professional, and they stand behind him. So these outlets are now being forced to essentially defend their stars rather than utilize them to promote the film or the TV show. And it's putting them in an awkward position. This is not what they signed up for. And I wonder if just the whole hassle of it all is going to prevent these people from getting new jobs in the future. Because these roles were booked and done before all the Me Too stuff came out. And I don't know if these people are going to be able to get jobs going forward. And then that raises the question, why shouldn't they? Is this a blacklisting of sorts when these people have not been convicted of any crimes or anything like that?
Yeah. And the other side of the coin from the standpoint of women, I think, is, you know, are we going to have this thing grind to a halt because you can't quite check all the boxes even when you know that something's wrong and someone has behaved in an inappropriate way? Will people who are powerful, because they are powerful, be able to stay where they are? And as a law professor that I spoke to for a piece that I just did, you know, there are simply no rules. Time's Up has acknowledged there are no clear rules when you're in the gray area. And I think it's going to be imperative to figure out how to go forward if anything meaningful is going to happen in terms of change. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The new documentary, Minding the Gap, starts as a look at two young skateboarders in Rockford, Illinois. Life is coming at Kier and Zach fast, and all they really want to do is skate.
We have to fully grow up, and it's going to suck.
When you're a kid, you just do. You just act. And then somewhere along the line, everyone loses that.
the film checks in with the boys from time to time, and as the years go by, we learn that fun-loving Zach is about to be a dad, but he's still grappling with his own difficult childhood.
You know, my parents ran this very controlling house, and so I ran away a lot. By like 16, I was no longer living with my parents, like, at all.
Kier, a thoughtful and soft-spoken young man, is just beginning to talk very tentatively about his own troubled youth.
How did you get disciplined?
I mean, well, they call it child abuse now, but...
The director of Minding the Gap is Bing Liu, himself a skateboarder from Rockford and a professional cameraman with more than 40 TV and movie credits. Liu started making Minding the Gap when he was a teenager, though he had no idea what it would eventually become, a Sundance Award winner produced by documentary icon Steve James. The film uses 12 years' worth of Verite footage to tell the story of three young men, Zach, Kier, and Liu himself, each coming of age in the shadow of abuse. Liu recently sat down with KCRW's Matt Holzman.
So how did you originally pick up the camera?
I saw like a couple of friends who were from the Chicago suburbs who I met, and they took skate video filming like really seriously. Like a friend of mine had like a Hi8 camera, you know, in middle school, and it's like, yeah, we dinked around and filmed a little bit.
Like a Sony Handycam.
Yeah, but like these guys, they had Sony Handycams as well, but they were like bigger. Oh. You know, they had like fish eyes that were just cost just as much as the camera. They were careful about the music they chose. They took a long time to edit. And these kids were like 14 or 15, you know?
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God. And so I wanted to get a camera. So I got a camera off eBay, borrowed some money from my mom and saved up some money for my dishwashing job and bought a little soccer mom camera.
Am I right that I kind of remember hearing saying that you actually broke your arm at one point? It was like, well, I can't skate for a little while, so maybe I'll just film my friends.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like sort of this message from the universe that, you know, like you suck. Like maybe you shouldn't. No, I mean, but it was a really bad break. It was a compound fracture, both my radius and my ulna. Took a long time both to heal and also like to be able to like bend my elbow again. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you actually ended up becoming a professional cameraman though.
Yeah. I was 23 when I joined the camera union. And then I just, you know, started working in the camera department for a long time. And then while I was doing that, I started shooting in indie films and
This is all in Chicago?
Mostly in Chicago. I mean, I'd go to New York and L.A. sometimes to do work, but mostly in Chicago, yeah.
Now, how old are you now?
29.
Okay, so over the last 5 years or so, how have you mostly made your living? Like, what have you worked on?
You know, everything from Chirac, the movie, to Shameless, the TV show, to car commercials, to being a camera operator in a documentary for a couple days. It's just been all over the map. I got my big directorial break when Steve James hired me in 2015 to direct three stories on his massive education series called America to Me, and that was awesome.
We're going to talk about that in a sec. I want to talk about your film. Minding the Gap is a film set in Rockford where you grew up, and it's a film that features a ton of skateboard footage. I mean, it's not about skateboarding, but it's about a bunch of kids who do skateboard, including yourself. And one of the things that makes the film so lyrical, and it's about really serious stuff, but it kind of makes it much lighter, is the fact that you have all this beautiful skateboard footage. And I'm just wondering, like, was that just you with your camera catching all that footage?
Well, first of all, if you did the math, it's probably like 10 or 15 minutes of skateboarding footage in the film. But because it's so different from, I think, what you usually see skateboarding as, that's what makes it feel like, you know, there's more of it than there actually is.
That's interesting. It's also really beautiful.
Yeah.
And also very, because a lot of the content is so kind of heart-wrenching when you see these characters skateboarding and you feel the freedom of that, it's kind of like you take a big deep breath. So maybe that's also why it feels so important.
Well, it was shot with the glide cam. I was running on foot, glide cam, DSLR, 16mm lens.
Is that just a kind of a version of a Steadicam?
It's a version of a Steadicam, same physics. You know, what keeps it steady is gravity. What allows you to pan and tilt effortlessly is a gimbal. And, you know, what it does physically is that it transfers all the shake and weight to your body. But this was, you know, very light thing where I could like unscrew it in three pieces and put it in a backpack and just run around with it.
So how did this movie come about? You're making a living as a cinematographer, as a camera operator, and you decide you're going to make your own film.
Well, I mean, it wasn't my first film. I did a 20-minute doc about these two Vietnamese immigrants that dealt with identity and family trauma. I made a film that emulated the film Slacker when I was 17. made a film that emulated the film Crash when I was 19. It actually got me a partial scholarship to go to film school, but it was still too expensive. So I went to school for English. And then Minding the Gap was just another side project of mine. You know, it started out as a film. It was about skateboarders' relationships with their families, with their fathers, you know, with their emotions. And then a year into it, I met Kier and Zach and decided to follow them. I should say I reconnected with Zach. But Kier, it was really like I was meeting him for the first time.
Right, because this is a film that has a bunch of footage of them and you when you're all very young. But I get the sense that you just happened to catch that because they were kids out there skateboarding like you were, not necessarily because you guys were close.
Yeah, I mean, Zach and I hung out a little bit. You know, I met him when I was 17 and I was a couple of years older. But then I moved to Chicago when I was 19. So, you know, we didn't really get to build a connection. Kier is 7 years younger than me. You know, I caught him a couple times at the skate park, but I had to source most of Kier's footage from other people. But they both knew who I was. I was the one who was like, you know, taking 5 years to edit a skate video. And it's like, oh, I want to be in Bing's video. So when I came back, they were probably really psyched to be filmed by me and then probably weirded out that I wanted to follow all these other aspects of their lives.
Documentary is casting, right? And you cast this brilliantly because they're such great characters and they bring so much to it. But why initially did you decide to go with these two guys?
Kier has an emotional openness, but at the time when I first started following him, he had all these unresolved things that he never talked about in terms of both his relationship with his father, but also in terms of his racial identity. He was talking about it for the first time, but he was so like on the fence. You know, he'd talk about things that his father did to him that made him angry, but he wouldn't let himself feel that anger completely. He'd waver between that and, you know, this intense love and respect that he had for his father. And I think that ultimately, that's what I saw a lot of my younger self in him.
And in terms of race, I mean, he's one of the only black kids skating amongst a lot of white kids.
I mean, that was why I actually wanted to interview him the first time. And then all this other stuff came out. But he sort of brushed that off, too. You know, he started talking about these things that made him feel uncomfortable that his friends did or said to him or called them. But he would always, like, justify it for them. He'd excuse them. He'd rationalize it. And I saw myself in that, too. Because it's sort of a survival mechanism when you're a person of color in a group of white friends. It's like you have to find a way to fit in and make them feel okay with this elephant in the room. And over time, you know, he sort of realizes like, no, that's not okay. You know, it matters a lot actually in the wider world that I'm black. And I had to have that realization as well.
So it does seem in watching the movie that you as a character, and we'll talk about you deciding to put yourself in the film, that all three of you kind of open up as time goes by, not necessarily even to the camera, but to yourselves. You're all kind of admitting to yourselves the things that have happened to you and how much they've affected your lives. And you kind of see that unfold.
Yeah, it's weird. Like this time in your life when you're an adolescent, you know, when you're a teenager, when you're in your early 20s, all that stuff matters, you know. And I think oftentimes we brush off the emotional up and downs of that era of our lives. But really, like that, those are the things that formulate who we become as adults. You know, we enter our 20s and our 30s and like jobs and school, career, family. And then all of a sudden we're like old. And
hey, easy.
Sorry, no, yeah, you know, but like in actuality, yeah, these monolithic things that happen, they feel monolithic, you know, when you're an adolescent, when you get your first car, or when you talk about your father for the first time, and we shouldn't brush that stuff off.
Yeah.
And that was the processing that happened.
Was there any ground rules in filming Kier and Zach? Because I know at one point, Zach is getting high and he kind of looks over his shoulder and he looks at the camera and he says, hey, you're going to use me getting high? And you say, maybe.
Are you going to put me smoking weed in the thing?
Maybe. Dude, I don't think just like, to do it.
I've given you free range. I mean, I have no stipulation.
And did you have any ground rules going when you started filming them?
No. I mean, I feel like we were beyond in the storytelling community. I think we're beyond, you know, this pretending that this fourth wall exists and, you know, like we're just going to move forward and, you know, this is actually just them and their natural element. I grew up in the time of postmodern, you know, storytelling. I was just obsessed with the idea of meta. I think that maybe that's something that has to do with my generation too, this millennial generation. It's like embracing how cameras and perspective affects the story is a more interesting question than pretending like it doesn't affect the story.
Well, that's interesting because the film is basically verite, and I know that you're very much kind of follow the edicts of verite filmmaking. And so in a way, it's not meta, but there are certainly these moments, and probably the most obvious moment is the interview with your mom, where you see the presence of the camera. In fact, you had another camera crew there filming you, filming her. But at the beginning, you weren't going to put yourself in the film at all. There was a little nod. There's a moment where you kind of nod to the fact that you too experienced some of the things that your other characters experienced when they were kids. Especially for a person who likes the meta, why weren't you going to put yourself in the film?
I like meta in the sense of it having a purpose, but I didn't set out to make a film about myself. Like, that's a different film. That's a different genre. That's a personal doc. Mm-hmm. And I never intended to make a personal doc. There's something that happened in the film that gave me a reason to do it. And it wasn't like, you know, this thing happened. It's like, okay, now I'm going to put myself in the film. It was like this thing happened and it brought up a lot of ethical questions. And I think, you know, in revealing the filmmaking, it sort of helped enrich those ethical questions to the point where it's not just an ethical question. It's like, oh no, this is interesting. Like, we have to pay attention to, you know, how the story is told in situations like this. I know I'm being very vague, but...
Well, we'll just say that you find out that there is abuse happening in a relationship amongst your other characters. And in fact, your mother was abused, you were abused, and your stepbrother, Kent, was abused. So including them in the story seemed like you kind of didn't have a choice in a way.
Well, there's parallels between issues of violence in the home, domestic violence, child abuse, and filmmaking. And in both, like, you have to deal with the question of privacy. I think they aligned really well by, you know, addressing both privacy in those relationships and those characters' lives and also in the filmmaking. Mm.
So that's a very intellectual, academic way of putting it. But then you had to ask your mom to sit down and talk with her about things that are really, really difficult. Yeah. How'd you ask her to sit down and talk about that stuff?
I think I just sent her an email saying, hey, mom, can I interview you for my project? And she was like, yeah. And then I think like the next five emails were about choosing a date.
So as simple as that, there wasn't a big emotional upheaval about that.
No, I mean, our relationship, and maybe it's our personalities, like we're very much just like open people and we just take it as it comes.
Or you're not dealing with what's really happening underneath.
Actually, yeah. And beneath that, we are not dealing with things.
Right.
I think us not dealing with it was not conscious. Like, you know, we weren't conscious of it. So,
right.
Yeah.
Coming up after a short break, Minding the Gap director Bing Liu tells us how the band The Mountain Goats changed his life and why the group is part of the reason his film ended up at Hulu. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're listening to a conversation between KCRW's Matt Holzman and Bing Liu, director of the new coming-of-age documentary, Minding the Gap. On one level, Minding the Gap is a movie about skateboarding in down-on-its-luck Rockford, Illinois. But as Kier, one of the film's young subjects, explains, for him, skateboarding is more than a hobby.
I could seriously be on the verge of having a mental breakdown, but as long as I'm able to go skate, I'm completely fine.
Minding the Gap follows skateboarders Kier and Zach over more than a decade as they move through a tough adolescence. Through all their ups and downs, skateboarding remains a constant. Liu gathered footage for years and went on to become a professional camera operator, mostly in and around Chicago. That's where he encountered documentary giant Steve James, whose company gave Minding the Gap a huge boost.
Steve James is one of the great documentary filmmakers of today, a man who originally came to most people's attention for co-directing Hoop Dreams. But he is part of the Chicago Film Collaborative, Kartemquin Films. And at some point, you connected with Kartemquin. How did that happen?
I had heard about a fellowship that they had called Diverse Voices in Documentary that helped filmmakers of color who had a project that they already started. So I applied, I think, like maybe with like 2 days to spare from the deadline. I was like, oh, cool, I'll just try it. And then I got in. And then, yeah, over time, they workshopped the film a little bit. And then afterwards, they loved the project so much, they approached me and were like, hey, can we co-produce this with you? And I think I was like 25 at the time. So I was like, sure, whatever I sign, you know. Right.
There isn't anybody better in the entire doc world to have you co-producing your movie than Kartemquin.
Yes,
right?
In hindsight, it's like, wow. Yeah. There's nothing like Kartemquin in the world of documentary. You know, it's really special. It's a really special place.
That's right. No, I have to ask the kind of pedestrian question, but at the end of the day, where did you find the money to make the film? I
must have written like 30 or 40 grants and got denied that many times. But along the way, I would go to things like Tribeca's industry meetings and, you know, I'd go to fellowships and I would just start meeting more and more people, and over time, the film, it was on people's lips more over time.
Yeah.
And it's like I'd always heard, like, once somebody wants to put money into it, everybody else is going to want to jump on it too.
Absolutely.
And there was a lot of truth to that.
Were you showing them a clip? Did you have a sizzle reel? What were people seeing?
By 2015, I had a rough cut.
Oh, you did?
Some applications asked for a 10-minute thing. Some asked for a rough cut. It just really depended on the grant. So I had a 3-minute sizzle, a 10-minute demo, and then a rough cut.
And that rough cut is what you submitted to Sundance, and you got in.
Yes.
This year.
Yes.
And you received a special award for breakthrough filmmaking. How different was the film that we saw at Sundance from the one that you were showing people a couple of years before?
It's hard.
a lot of iterations?
Yeah, I've had so many iterations. I mean, I was just constantly cutting. You know, I was just like cutting in my room, you know, like anytime I had free time but I didn't have the time to go to Rockford, I'd be cutting, you know, Yeah, people at Kartemquin like always joked about it. It's like, how many versions of this thing do you have?
So you actually cannot answer that question.
I literally cannot answer. Yeah, I can't.
Now, in June, Sundance is in January, and in June, Hulu announces that they're going to distribute the film. And I'm wondering, what was happening in those months? Were there feverish negotiations going on, or what was happening in the interim?
Yeah, I mean, this is unprecedented. I mean, so Hulu, they didn't have an originals documentary department until last year. So this is their second year doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So let me back up. POV, which is a PBS strand, you know, they're in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They program amazing documentaries. They were the first people to put money in the film. And that happened in late 2016. And then shortly after, we got ITVS, which is in San Francisco. They're a big PBS funder of independent documentaries. So PBS basically funded the film.
Mm-hmm.
But they had TV rights. So, I mean, that was sort of ultimately what had to be negotiated. And that's what took the time that it did.
That makes things really complicated.
Yeah.
And Hulu was like, okay, we want this film. We're going to work it out however we have to work it out.
Yeah, I mean, we had our first meeting at Sundance. I went to like the Hulu condo or whatever. And and we sat down and it was like, yeah, they really talked about how they loved the film. They really got it. Belissa Balaban, she and I talked about The Mountain Goats for like half an hour, you know, and how much that music affected us. And that really... Yeah, that made me really like...
The Mountain Goats is the final song in the movie is by The Mountain Goats.
Yeah.
What was the significance of that?
Well, The Mountain Goats is really the brainchild of John Darnielle, and he is just this prolific musician. But in 2007, he put out this album called The Sunset Tree, and it was all about him growing up with this abusive stepfather and how he survived it. And it wasn't sad. It was like... You could like nod your head to it, you know. It was uplifting.
It was so, kind of We Shall Overcome.
It was like We Shall Overcome. And on the inside sleeve of the CD, it was like, this is for everybody who's survived abuse, and this is to let you know that you will live to tell your tale. And that, as well as the tone of how he talked about violence in the home and childhood, that was like a watershed moment for me when I first listened to that growing up.
You were a person who really got through a lot of tough times with music and movies and
books. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, like when I was part of why I made Mind in the Gap was that I wanted to make a film that I think could help other people survive.
Bing Liu is the director of the new documentary, Minding the Gap. It is a beautiful movie, and thank you for coming and talking with us on The Business.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Mario Diaz and Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.